Good morning. On today's programme, we hear about Turkey's role in salvaging the Black Sea grain deal and from the towns and villages around Ukraine's southern front. But first we go to Egypt, where the tightly policed two-week-long World Climate Change Summit, COP27, opens today. The summit takes place in the Red Sea resort of Sharm el-Sheikh, a welcome boost for a place which has seen a decline in tourism in recent years. Less welcome for the Egyptian hosts, however, will be the focus on the country's human rights problems and Egypt's own environmental record. Decades of mass tourism in the country have taken a toll on waters, coral reefs and natural spaces in the country's most popular resort city. From Sharm el-Sheikh, Isabel Conway reports.
A gift from Allah. At last I'll have customers, murmurs Saeed, unpacking a stack of gold sandals decorated with the head of iconic pharaoh Tutankhamun. He wipes dusty souvenirs of plaster camels and minuscule pyramids, arranging a rainbow of flowing scarves above his humble stall in a laneway behind Sharm el-Sheikh's Sahaba Mosque. Further along the coast, in the famous Red Sea Resort's newest district, Soho Square, an entertainment mecca of dancing fountains, nightclubs and international restaurants, other businesses are awaiting a foreign currency bonanza, all thanks to the estimated 30,000 visitors arriving for the COP27 two-week-long climate change conference. Sharm el-Sheikh underwent a massive makeover in preparation for COP27. New hotels were completed, a large-scale road widening project added, a magnificent new museum showcasing mummies among the collection of over 5,000 treasures from antiquity has opened. Miles of bike paths have also been laid, along with a long promenade filled with street architecture and seating. 150 new electric buses will shuttle the visitors to and from the conference village through empty desert landscapes to the many hotels spread across 9 coastal and inland city locations. In the final countdown before COP27, I watch labourers painting and retiling pavements and a frenzy of planting and road sweeping together with the installation of more security checkpoints and cordons around the massive Congress complex. While boosting badly needed revenue, some environmentalists have raised concerns that the influx of international visitors could further damage the Red Sea and its fragile ecosystem in world-famous Ras Mohammed National Park. Dive instructor and environmentalist Mohammed Al-Malawi instructs first-time divers before they disappear into an underwater wonderland populated by multicoloured fish and corals. At Stingray Station, so many are already in the water that snorkelers end up cheek by jowl together. Decades of mass tourism have taken a toll on the waters, coral reefs and natural spaces of Egypt's most popular resort. Locals as well as visitors must be made more aware of the necessity to protect it, Mohammed stresses. It's a perfect opportunity now to put Egypt and Sharm in the international spotlight, boosting tourism but also a better awareness of the riches we possess here, he adds. Egyptian environmentalists are hopeful that a greener future for the city will be Sharm el-Sheikh's future legacy after COP27. Educating the nation that their actions have consequences for the world around them. But visitors also need to be more mindful of their responsibilities. As we watch children on board our boat throw plastic bottles on the deck, where they can easily blow overboard, there's little or no parental input, and no members of the crew reprimand them or point to the bins. Mohammed races back and forth, catching the flimsy plastic beakers used for soft drinks offered with lunch on board that are blowing around in the breeze and some end up in the water. In response to increasing amounts of plastic waste thrown into the Red Sea by tourists, single-use plastics were banned here in 2019. Rules are nothing without enforcement, one prominent environmentalist has pointed out. We already have signs everywhere asking people not to throw their garbage in the sea or feed the fish. They don't listen a lot of the time and they're not reprimanded because tourists are valuable in Sharm. Sharif Kairat, who organises clean-up initiatives in the Red Sea, has said. For World Report, I'm Isabel Conway in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt.
Next we go to Turkey and to the Black Sea, which became a focal point last week when Russia suspended its participation in the shipment of grain to the rest of the world. Turkey and the UN scrambled to keep the ships sailing, and to general surprise, they managed to persuade Russia to return 4 days later. Then the NATO Secretary General flew to Istanbul, and Turkey went back to playing the role of the odd person out. From Ankara, Jasper Mortimer reports.
On Wednesday this past week, Turkey could have been the brightest star in the sky. The government of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan received universal praise for having persuaded Russia to resume its role in the Black Sea grain shipments. But the next night, Turkey's star dimmed after it reiterated its opposition to Sweden and Finland's joining NATO. The saga began last Saturday, when Russia withdrew its staff from the Joint Coordination Center, the unit in Istanbul that controls the flow of grain-carrying ships to and from Ukraine. The Russians said they were withdrawing because Ukraine had attacked their naval base at Sevastopol, damaging a warship. Ukraine laughed at the accusation, saying the Russians had suffered an accident with their own explosives. What happened in Sevastopol is unclear, but Russia had a need to retaliate. Ukraine is making a lot of money from exporting grain at the high prices engendered by the war. The next day, no ships sailed down the corridor in the Black Sea minefields. When commodity markets opened on Monday, the price of wheat rose 4 to 5%. The US and EU condemned the Russian pullout. US Secretary of State Antony Blinken accused Russia of turning hunger into a weapon. And the two statesmen who had negotiated the grain deal, President Erdogan and UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, worked intensively to revive it. The remaining staff at the Joint Coordination Center did their best to keep the shipments flowing. They continued to inspect the ships, making sure they weren't carrying arms, and they gave the captains permission to sail. A total of 19 ships sailed through the corridor on Monday and Tuesday. Russia said this was unacceptable, and the Russian Navy dominates the Black Sea. The JCC announced no ships would sail on Wednesday. It seemed to be suffering a loss of nerve. But when Wednesday came, Erdogan announced the Russian inspectors would return to the JCC at noon. Russia confirmed this, saying it had received written guarantees from Ukraine that it would not use the corridor for military purposes. The Russian statement appeared to be a face-saver. What seemed to have happened was that Erdogan and Guterres had persuaded Russian President Vladimir Putin the shipments of grain were important. Important to the African and Asian countries whose support Russia craves. On Thursday, 7 ships sailed from Ukraine, carrying wheat, corn, sunflower meal, sunflower oil, and soybeans. 3 ships went to China, and 1 each to Italy, Netherlands, Oman, and Spain. Also on Thursday, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg arrived in Turkey. After talks with Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu, Stoltenberg told the press that Sweden and Finland had significantly strengthened their measures against terrorism, establishing a joint mechanism with Turkey. It was now time, Stoltenberg said, to welcome Finland and Sweden as full members of NATO. Cavusoglu disagreed. He said Finland and Sweden had taken certain steps, but more was required. One of the people that Turkey wants Sweden to extradite is Amina Karabaveh, a member of parliament. Born in Iran, Karabaveh fought for a Kurdish guerrilla group as a teenager, but she put down her gun and fled to Sweden when she was 19. In Stockholm, she took a degree, became a citizen, and was elected to parliament. There she has criticized Turkey for its treatment of the Kurds. Turkey says Karabaveh has links to the PKK, the Turkish Kurdish insurgent group. But the Swedes see her as a law-abiding citizen, and they are not going to deport her. Essentially, Stoltenberg is saying the 30 member states of NATO have run out of patience with Turkey's blocking Swedish and Finnish membership. In a multilateral body, there is a limit to how far you can push your own agenda. This is Jasper Mortimer for World Report in Ankara.
Finally, to Ukraine and the city of Kherson, which is expected to be the focus of a major battle between Ukrainian forces seeking to free the city from Russian aggression. The city has been under Russian control since March, but Ukraine's forces are closing in. Some of the villages and towns around Kherson have been liberated by the Ukrainian military, but despite liberation, life in those villages and towns has changed forever, as Hannah McCarthy reports now from the southern front in Ukraine.
An aircraft flies over the fields of brown sunflowers in front of us. A few moments later, plumes of white smoke are trailing from the plane. Then suddenly, a low boom as several bombs hit the ground, and presumably a target. We're about 12 kilometres from the front line in southern Ukraine, and Ukrainian air pilots are targeting areas around the city of Kherson. The city has been under the control of Russian forces since the beginning of March. It was the first Ukrainian city to fall under Russian occupation. The battle for Kherson will dictate whether Russia can maintain its grip on southern Ukraine, or whether it will be forced to retreat, like it has in many parts of the east. Most of the territory around Kherson is under a media blackout and a no-go area for journalists. But along with another French journalist, local mayor Oleg Polupenko is escorting me through the military checkpoints to visit some of the villages that he oversees. We travel in the same direction as the Ukrainian bomber jet before stopping in the village of Zeleny High. It's a pretty bucolic village with cottages dotted around open fields. Earlier in the war, this village was on the front line, which has now shifted eastward. The Russians came through here as they tried to take the nearby city of Mykolaiv. The local population has dwindled from 16,000 people to just 3,000, and shelling from tanks and artillery are still regularly heard in the near distance. The newly appointed commander for Russian forces in the Kherson region, Sergei Sorovkin, is a man known for his brutal and relentless bombardment of Aleppo and Idlib in Syria. We leave our car by a checkpoint in Zeleny High and walk through an overgrown path. The mayor wants to show us the local school. It's completely destroyed. A once large two-story building is now a pile of rubble after missiles struck the school in March. The director of the school died, but fortunately no children were in the school at the time. Now there are only 20 students left in the area. Most have been evacuated to safe parts of Ukraine or elsewhere in Europe. They destroy schools and hospitals because they want to leave us with no future, says the mayor. Surveying the village on a still warm autumn day is somewhat deceiving. There's no electricity for the remaining villagers, and the unforgiving cold season will soon begin. The military will distribute gas so that people can try to keep warm, but everyone is expecting a brutal winter. The mayor described how he was targeted by Russian forces in March. He changed his location every night, but locals who supported Russia informed on him. Some of the elderly residents in the village still believe that Ukraine was better off as part of the Soviet Union. At one point, a rocket-propelled grenade known as an RPG was launched at his car, says the mayor. In the end, he was detained by Russian forces and held at a camp in nearby Chernobyvka. Ukrainian forces targeted that village as part of its counteroffensive, and the mayor recalls fearing Ukrainian artillery would kill him while he was held by the Russians. What should happen to the villagers who collaborated with the Russian forces, I ask the mayor. They should go to Russia or face life in prison here, he says. A reminder that the end of the war will not mean a return to life as it was before for this little village in southern Ukraine. Prosecutors have already opened hundreds of cases against Ukrainians who are accused of treason and collaboration. Police, doctors and teachers have all been accused so far, but the line between an act of collaboration and one of survival is not always clear. Afterwards, we travel to another village closer to the front line. We stop at a church where locals are hurriedly stockpiling bags of food in a small domed Orthodox church. The booms of missiles come closer. At one point, the men stop to stare at the sky. They watch as small bits of matter from an exploded missile fall to the ground. Months of artillery attacks have seemingly desensitized them to the very real danger that surrounds them. We, however, decide it's time to leave for a safer location. As we drive through fields of dead sunflowers, the driver points to the field beside us. It's an M777, he says, referring to a type of missile manufactured by America, while pointing to a trail of white smoke in the field. He immediately picks up speed, and we race through the military checkpoints to the relative safety of Mykolaiv. For World Report in Kherson, I'm Hannah McCarthy.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. But until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.